Facing pushback from educators, parents, and health officials, the Texas Education Agency rolls back its initial orders for in-person classes in the fall. Details today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. We'll have more on new guidance for Texas public schools in the fall. Also, how parents in Texas's largest metro area are trying to juggle mixed messages over back-to-school plans. New research in Texas showing promise for those suffering from COVID-19. And a new study on the connection between natural gas flaring and premature births, plus much more. When the Texas Standard gets underway, right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 20th day of July, 2020. Hope your Monday's been a good one so far. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. As New York City, once the epicenter of the pandemic in the U.S., enters its fourth phase of reopening, the view from Texas is considerably different, you might say. 7,300 new coronavirus cases were reported yesterday, and a total of 3,958 deaths were officially attributed to COVID-19. The Texas Tribune reports that reflects a 20% increase over the previous week, and Texas is not making moves toward reopening, quite the contrary. As we reported here on Friday, Governor Abbott is fending off social media rumors of a shutdown, while the Texas Education Agency, or TEA, is backpedaling on initial plans for a statewide reopening of public school campuses. According to new guidelines issued on Friday, public schools in Texas are being given more latitude to keep campuses closed deeper into the fall school term. The TEA is facing backlash from educators, parents, and health officials, objecting to its previous order that would have given public schools just 3 weeks from the start of school to reopen classrooms for in-person instruction. So writes Aaliyah Swaby of the Texas Tribune, and she joins us now with the latest. Aaliyah, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
I know that you were privy to what the TEA was saying earlier. What is the agency saying now about how public schools in Texas can reopen?
So on Friday, they decided instead to allow public schools a total of up to 8 weeks to reopen their classrooms for in-person instruction. Those 8 weeks, they can limit which students come on campus. And, you know, that's a big change for a lot of districts that, you know, maybe would have opened sometime in October or September even. Now they have, in some cases could be up to November before they fully open back for all of the kids who want to be on campus.
Of course, sometime in November, if they had originally planned to open in September. Just to be clear, they have to get some kind of order from local health officials before they can ask the TEA for that permission. Is that right?
No. So they can delay that on-campus instruction for 4 weeks now, and then they have to ask the state if they want to continue that delay for up to four additional weeks in areas that are hit hard by the pandemic. And, you know, separately, they can also delay bringing kids on campus if local health officials mandate that they do so. So there are various ways that schools might end up not having students on campus in the fall.
There are some parents who want their kids back in the classroom in some districts. What is the TEA saying about reopening classrooms per se? That is to say, I understand that they are pushing off when they have to reopen classes, but are they making any accommodations for those parents who want their kids to go back to school?
So parents who don't have access to reliable technology, to Wi-Fi hotspots, to computers, must be able to send their students into a classroom every day. So unless a district definitively has provided all of its students with the resources that they need to learn virtually and have the same access to instruction as other students, they have to open their classrooms. And during the second 4 weeks of that remote learning, districts have to start ramping up. So they have to educate at least some kids on campus. They can restrict that number, but they have to bring at least some kids on, and they have to have a plan for what the public health factors are for them to reopen. So maybe that's, you know, the positivity rate going down or changing in some way. And if that happens, then they would bring more kids on campus. They have to say that in advance to receive allowance to get that second 4 weeks of remote learning.
Is the state doing anything to address this internet gap that we currently have? I mean, there are a lot of people who don't have access to hotspots or reliable internet service.
So the state announced Friday that they're going to put $200 million of federal stimulus funds into helping districts get devices and hotspots and routers. On top of the state had previously said that it would reimburse districts up to 75% of their pandemic-related expenses, also using money from a federal grant that went to the governor's office. It remains to be seen exactly what that means for districts. You know, it's not covering all of those expenses, but it is an assist in those costs, which can get up pretty high. I think districts across the country are you know, crunching the numbers and seeing what it costs them to actually get set up to teach kids during the pandemic, and the numbers aren't looking great.
What about the response from the public education community when it comes to these new changes?
So educator groups are still saying that Texas isn't going far enough, and that the new revisions, they've called them arbitrary. They've said that they're not based enough in science, and they, you know, they don't get at the fact that even after those 8 weeks, there might still be districts that are not in the position to reopen their campuses. So they want it to be allowed for districts to keep their campuses closed for as long as they need to keep their community safe, instead of having it be a number like 8 weeks that's statewide and, you know, not allowing for locals to make those decisions.
Is it clear why the TEA changed its guidelines?
I think that, you know, with this pandemic getting worse in Texas, and educators across the state saying that they wouldn't be coming back to work if there weren't different regulations in place, and if they were forced to go back into classrooms. In some places, that could mean teacher shortages, and that would be harder for everyone. So I think, you know, I don't know for sure what the conversations were behind closed doors, but, you know, you have to imagine that the external pressure that there was to allow for more flexibility had something to do with it.
Aaliyah Swaby is an education reporter for the Texas Tribune. Aaliyah, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The Tyler School Board voted unanimously to change the names of its two high schools, currently named for Robert E. Lee and John Tyler. As KERA's Brett Jaspers reports, both namesakes were prominent Confederate leaders.
Cornelius Shackelford Sr. is a 2006 graduate of John Tyler High School. He played football, baseball, and ran track for the school the rest of the state knows as Tyler John Tyler. And though he didn't think much about his school's name when he was a student, now he believes it needs to change.
The way that the schools came up and the way that they were named, it really comes off as it was a response to the civil rights being passed and Black people having equal rights to whites.
The city is named for John Tyler, a former president who pushed for the annexation of Texas. He also owned slaves. At the end of his life, John Tyler joined the Confederate legislature. About a century later, as a response to the civil rights movement, the town renamed its high schools for John Tyler and the Confederate general, Robert E. Lee. Shackelford calls it a spit in the face for Black people like his family. Over the years, there were efforts to change the school names. The last failed in 2018. Mission Bonner is also a Black parent and Tyler resident. She said the push to change the name started again after police killed George Floyd.
We protested. It was just a few in numbers starting out, but gradually it increased. We sent emails to the school board in regards to the name change daily. I mean, all day, every day. Calls, phone calls, text messaging.
The Tyler School Board held a special meeting Thursday night. Residents spoke at the lectern and protested outside. Over 2 hours later, the board made its decision.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries 7-0.
The last time the board talked about the names was in 2018. Andy Bergfeld, a board member who's white, said back then he thought the idea was more tied to a progressive movement he didn't agree with. At Thursday's meeting, he said his stance on the names has changed.
There is a general consensus among the mature leaders of this community, both white and black, that are not part of the progressive movement, that believe having our only two high schools prominently linked to the Confederacy and its ties to slavery needs to come to an end.
The Tyler ISD board will now consider how to exactly go about finding a new name and getting community suggestions. The current draft policy wouldn't allow naming a school after another person to avoid future controversy. Mission Bonner can agree with that.
Call it Freedom High School or something. I don't know, but anything that all races would appreciate and show some type of dignity to it.
Whatever the choices are, Board President Wade Washman said he wants to move quickly. I'm Brett Jaspers in Dallas.
Indeed, the Tyler School Board will be taking up those name changes, what next steps to do later tonight. Joining us once again, Wells Dunbar, our social media editor. Wells, what are you seeing out there?
Hey, David. Well, that state walkback of its initial call for in-person classes primarily being met with applause on social media. On her Facebook page, Jonna Blackley says the TEA's demand for in-person instruction reminded him of unfunded mandates, those times when lawmakers wave a pen and say, make it so, without allocating any money to actually make it so. These days, I feel like I'm hearing a lot of similar stuff, he writes, only applied to the health of the population. Get back in school, but don't spread the virus. Get back to work, but don't spread the virus. He ends his comment by asking, what if the officials issuing these mandates were to ask the people on the front line if it's actually possible to carry them out first? That fall school semester barreling down at us and a hot topic on social media. Just one of the stories we're keeping an eye on. How about that Texas Republican convention this weekend? More on that coming up in the Texas Roundup midway through the show, and we will have reactions from social media at the end of the show as well.
Yes, and Wells Dunbar will be joining us with more of your comments in about 35 minutes or so.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. There are more than 2,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 among children in Harris County, and that now adds to a new set of worries for parents. As Houston area schools firm up plans for going back to school, Houston Public Media's Paul Benedetto looked into how parents are juggling family life with the potential health risks for kids.
Cedric Dark is an emergency room doctor, a professor, and a parent. And the work he does at home comes with the added responsibility of caring for his kindergarten-age son.
Even though it's like I'm home more, have a lot more time more, it's like to be able to try to get anything done, it's really hard and kind of get that guilt trip of having like the TV or video games, babysit your kid.
Dark's emergency room shifts provide another concern, bringing COVID-19 home to his family. When he gets there, he wipes down his phone and his keys. He doesn't wear his work shoes inside and he showers as soon as he walks in the door.
That's kind of where I think it gets really tough is everybody's got to manage a lot of these things in their context in their own family.
Dark's just one of many parents worried about their children during the pandemic. Even with face masks, hand washing, and social distancing, the threat of illness is still there. Dr. Stacy Rose is an infectious disease expert at Baylor College of Medicine. She points out children in isolation still require hands-on attention.
Those same rules apply, whether it's a child or an adult, recognizing that, yes, you are going to have to put your hands on that kid and do what's necessary to care for them
when they can't care for themselves.
And for parents, that also means you're more likely to contract the illness.
If you're a parent and your child is sick, odds are you've been exposed.
Dr. Rose also expressed concern about children socializing at schools and daycares, even when protocols such as face masks are in place.
Kids are kids, and they're going to want to be with each other, and touch their face, and touch their mask. And yet, we have to do everything we can to try to reduce the risk of spread, both within the kids and also from kids to adults.
While many cases in children have been mild, there are still risks. A number of children who had COVID-19 later died from an inflammatory illness called multi-system inflammatory condition in children. And Dr. Susan McClellan, an infectious disease expert at University of Texas Medical Branch, says there's still a lot we don't know.
They may have even had asymptomatic COVID, but then they present with this inflammatory syndrome that can be fatal.
Some school districts, like the Houston Independent School District, have announced they'll be starting classes online amid COVID-19. But that comes with its own set of challenges.
When you think about it, my kid's fairly privileged. We got Wi-Fi and tablets to do, you know, online learning stuff. His school has this online learning thing that they do. So, like, when we hit the pandemic, we were able to get that kind of education in there. And I don't know, it can't be the same thing for every single kid in Houston.
HISD says it could start in-person classes as soon as October, but that depends on whether COVID-19 gets under control across the region. I'm Paul DiBenedetto in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. In the mid-2010s, the Eagle Ford Shale in South Texas was among the most productive oil and gas fields in the world. Hydraulic fracturing, better known as fracking, allowed drillers to tap previously inaccessible fossil fuels, but doing so came at a cost. A new report shows a higher rate of premature births among mothers in the region who lived near flaring sites where drillers burn off excess natural gas. Joining us now is one of the authors of the study. Laura Cushing is an environmental health scientist at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. Professor Cushing, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi.
I can recall maybe a couple of years ago people talking about the possibility that there might be some sort of association between the flaring of natural gas and premature births. What did you set out to find in your study?
Well, flaring is a very visible practice, right? You can see it happening. If you live near it, you can see it right outside your door. So we too were hearing concerns that there may be some impacts to health from this practice and kind of set out to look at it. No one had ever conducted a human health study around flaring sites as far as we were aware. And so our goal with this study was to look at adverse birth outcomes. And what we found is, as you said, a higher rate of preterm birth amongst mothers who lived within about 3 miles of a large amount of flaring activity. And preterm birth is when a baby is born too early, before 37 completed weeks.
You said a higher rate of complications. How much higher?
Well, moms who lived within 5 kilometers or about 3 miles of a high amount of flaring had a 50% higher odds of having a preterm baby than moms who did not live near any flaring.
50% greater rate. What is the theory behind this? Why would that be happening?
Well, we don't know for sure. As I said, this is kind of the first study to look at health impacts near flaring from oil and gas development. But we do know that burning natural gas releases air pollutants that have been linked to preterm birth in other contexts. So we can't say for sure, but it is a rather large association that we found.
How can you be sure that there aren't some other factors at work in this data? For instance, issues of access to health care, larger rates of smoking, that sort of thing. How do you filter for that?
Well, we control for as many of those things as we can in our analysis. So we did have data. The study included information on over 20,000 women, and we did know about their prenatal care, how much prenatal care they got. We have information on whether they smoked. We know about their education levels and a bunch of other things. So we are able to control for those in the analysis. And we can say with quite a bit of certainty that that is not the reason for this increased odds of preterm birth for women living near flaring.
So when you were formulating your hypothesis in advance of actually conducting this study, are these the results that you expected to see at the outset?
Well, we did expect there might be some effects of flaring. I have to say the size of that association was larger than I expected. It's on par with what you see in terms of the increased risk of preterm birth among women who smoke compared to those who don't. So it is a pretty high effect. And one of the other surprising things was that we saw the association was strongest among Hispanic and Latina women, so that they were more at risk than non-Hispanic white women in the area. Again, we don't know the exact reasons for that, but other studies have similarly found that people of color are more vulnerable to air pollutant exposures. So we think it has something to do with structural racism and the way that structures opportunity, housing, education, occupation. They may be predisposed to seeing an effect of flaring because of wear and tear on their physiological systems due to chronic stress, perhaps related to poverty or experiences of racial discrimination. So again, we're not able to say for sure because we didn't measure these things, but we do know that it's not because Hispanic women have different rates of smoking or education, because as I said, we were able to control for those things in our study. In the past, you know, flaring was prohibited, but those regulations have been weakened over time. So our study suggests, you know, because of these community health impacts, we might need to take another look at that.
Laura Cushing is an environmental health scientist at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. We'll have a link to more over at texasstandard.org. Professor Cushing, thanks for speaking with us on The Standard.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And we are fast approaching 29 minutes past the hour. The Texas Roundup is just around the corner.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, dedicated to the fight against cancer through telemedicine, providing patients with the ability to conduct online virtual appointments. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The Texas Republican Party is replacing its chairman. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports the vote tallied early this morning capped off a convention plagued with technical difficulties and legal challenges.
Former Florida Congressman Alan West is the Texas Republican Party's new chairman. West defeated Chairman James Dickey, who had been seeking a second full term. West claimed victory at around 3:30 this morning, with Dickey conceding defeat about an hour later. West's victory came amid a convention that had come apart under Dickey's leadership. Back-and-forth legal challenges ultimately led to the convention being held online, and technical glitches forced its delay an entire day. Late Sunday night, delegates voted to take up unfinished business at a second convention after settling party leadership races. West represented Florida's 22nd congressional district from 2011 to 2013 and built a national profile railing against then-President Barack Obama. He moved to Texas in 2014 to take the helm of a now-defunct Dallas think tank. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
COVID-19 cases are surging among Houston City employees. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner said Friday 286 municipal workers, not including police and firefighters, have tested positive for the virus. Two active city employees also died from COVID-19 within 24 hours.
One was last at work in June, and the other was last at work on July the 8th. So you can see that this virus is very much present and having an impact even on City of Houston itself.
Turner says hospitalizations and deaths will keep increasing without the governor mandating a statewide shutdown to slow the spread of coronavirus. Houston remains a hotspot with the highest number of active cases in the state at more than 36,000. And more U.S. military medical teams are arriving in Texas to help hospitals manage surging numbers of coronavirus patients. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame has more.
Medical teams from the Army and Navy are fanning out across the state to work side by side with civilian hospital employees. The teams are made up mostly of nurses and respiratory specialists. Five Navy teams started work Sunday at hospitals in Del Rio, Eagle Pass, Rio Grande City, and Harlingen. Army medical personnel began embedding with five San Antonio area hospitals on July 9th. In recent days, more have been sent to Houston and McAllen. In total, the Defense Department has assigned about 580 personnel to Texas for the COVID crisis. Not all have deployed yet. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
And I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
As communities grapple with the coronavirus pandemic, new developments unfold continuously. Catch up on the day's news from around the world and across Texas by listening to All Things Considered, weekday afternoons on your local NPR station.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Throughout this pandemic, doctors and researchers have been looking for answers, trying to understand COVID-19, how to prevent its spread, how to treat those who get it. It's in this latter pursuit that a San Antonio hospital has found itself as the largest study site for a drug we've heard a bit about, remdesivir. University Hospital in San Antonio has enrolled more patients than any other research site in the world in the current second phase of the clinical trial. Dr. Thomas Patterson is leading the efforts at University Hospital. Dr. Patterson, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has given the tentative go-ahead on remdesivir's use. Remind us, what did they see that gave them hope?
So remdesivir is an antiviral drug, the first antiviral that's really shown to have efficacy against the virus that causes the COVID-19 infection. In the first phase of the clinical trial sponsored by the NIH, basically looked at remdesivir compared to placebo to determine if remdesivir was safe and effective. And it did show that remdesivir reduced the recovery time significantly for patients with COVID-19 infection.
Well, I understand you've enrolled 96 patients. I'd venture to guess that means you have some personal hope in this treatment, too.
We do. So in the first phase of the trial, Act 1 was placebo-controlled, so we didn't know who got the drug, but we did see patients get better fast, and so that was encouraging. In the second phase of the study, because of the success of the first, we were able to now know that every patient enrolled in the trial would get remdesivir. On top of that, we looked at another drug called baricitinib to see if it would further improve outcomes, and that drug reduces inflammation, and so that drug was compared to a placebo in an active compound so we could determine its efficacy. But because we knew everybody got the remdesivir, we could see faster responses. I saw a number of patients in follow-up from the trial who talked about how when they received remdesivir, they could basically feel almost immediately better. Their fever dropped, their myalgias improved, and other symptoms would pretty rapidly improve as well. You know, when you say, well, recovery time was 30% better, you went from 15 days down to 11, it may not sound that dramatic, but in terms of being able to get patients out of hospital to really preserve our hospital capacity,
right,
that's really
right.
A very big deal. And for patients, it's obviously very encouraging to recover that significantly faster.
Well, now, right now, doctor, is remdesivir an option for patients outside of the trial?
It is a limited option, but the issue with remdesivir now is that it's still approved under what was called an emergency use authorization. And initially, Gilead, the drug company that made the drug, gave a substantial number of courses to the U.S. government to distribute as they saw fit according to the need in various parts of the country. Subsequently, that's evolved into allowing hospitals to purchase remdesivir, but still they can only purchase the amount that is allocated to them based on formulas developed by health departments.
Is there enough to go around?
Well, there's really not enough to go around. I think as infectious disease clinicians and other providers, we work to make sure the patients who need it most are more likely to get it. So these are hospitalized patients, so everybody is pretty sick. Most of them are on oxygen. So there's kind of a sweet spot. Patients need to be sick enough, but not too sick to benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know it sounds like you've seen enough to put some hope in remdesivir, and especially in combination with this other drug. What might make you change your mind at this juncture?
Well, I think there is a lot of hope with the remdesivir improving outcomes. I think the issue would be, can we do better? If you look at the supply, though, you know, at University Hospital, for example, we admitted just slightly less than 250 new patients from mid-June till early July, and we had allocated to us a slightly more than 50 courses of remdesivir. So clearly not enough for everybody to receive the drug that might potentially benefit. So it's really important to have real careful discussions with your doctors. And I think it's important for the doctors that treat these patients to be networked together. Here in San Antonio, we weekly have discussions of best practices and what's worked and what hadn't worked.
With phase two, what comes next? What's your timeline looking like right now?
The follow-up period is for 4 weeks, and so that'll be through the end of July. And so probably in the next month after that, we will have early results from this trial. So for your listeners, that may seem like a long time, but for a 1,000-person trial to become active and then analyzed in that period of time is really quite a feat to move these therapies ahead.
Dr. Thomas Patterson is chief of infectious disease at UT Health. He is also with University Hospital in San Antonio, where he's leading research into the effectiveness of remdesivir in combination with anti-inflammatories as a treatment for COVID-19. Dr. Patterson, thanks again.
Thank you.
My name is Cameron Owens, and I'm the founder of Coaching Curls Workshops. This workshop is a Gold Award project. The Gold Award project is the highest award that a Girl Scout can get that has to be sustainable, and it has to help your community in some way. I saw a need for hair care in the foster community, especially with like little black girls. A lot of them don't have mothers of their same skin tone, of their same hair texture, and so I realized, well, I should get them some help. Because I know with my own experiences with my hair, if I was struggling and I have a black mom, then I can't imagine what these moms are going through. A neighbor a few houses down, I became friends with their daughter, and she has these two twin sisters. Both of them are mixed, both have beautiful curly hair, but they just didn't like their hair. And I thought that was so sad. So I sought out a team, and then after that, I realized I needed outreach to the foster community and got together like a course of what was gonna be happening in the workshop. And then we had, I think, our first workshop in August. Whenever they first came in, I could tell that they were willing to learn, and I really loved that about them. Like, they're just willing to listen to everything we had to offer. In the workshop, our first half is the presentation of all the information. So we're like, okay, so let's start off with detangling. So what kind of comb do you use? Use this comb. And then we tell them what type of products to use. So they were getting everything they needed in that first half of the workshop. And then in the second half is when we would like basically analyze each kid's hair. And while we were detangling their hair, we were having the parents learn hands-on, which was a big part to me because I wanted to make sure that these kids left with a style they actually liked and would keep their hair protected. The twins that I was talking about that really didn't like their hair, once they got this new hairstyle, they were literally jumping for glee. They were like, I love my hair. And I really saw the joy in the parents' face because they hadn't seen that before. My name is Cameron Owens. I'm the founder of Coaching Curls Workshop. I am a Gold Award recipient, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. It's been almost 3 weeks since Governor Greg Abbott issued an order requiring Texans to wear masks in public spaces. The order applies to any county with 20 or more cases of COVID-19, with a few exemptions. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports on how the order is going over in the Texas capital city.
James is an electrician in Austin. He doesn't want to use his full name because he doesn't want to get in trouble at work. Basically, James got exposed to COVID-19 at work. Even though he's been religiously using a mask since the early days of the pandemic, he says a lot of people around him have not. That includes a customer.
I would be in the elevator waiting for him to use his badge, and he would come into the elevator, "Oh, sorry, my mask," and then he would put it on. I was there with him all week, and that happened a lot.
And then James started feeling sick one Friday night. He was particularly concerned because he knew he had a lot of underlying issues that made contracting COVID-19 extra dangerous.
Asthma, blood pressure, of Hispanic descent.
At first, James thought it might just be his asthma that was making breathing a little harder than usual. But by Sunday afternoon, James was running a fever.
From then, it was like five days of fever and cough. Basically, between the fifth and the seventh day is when I really went down and went into full-blown pneumonia.
James says he never ended up going to the hospital, but he did some telemedicine visits with a doctor. James had an oximeter, so he was making sure his oxygen levels didn't get too low. So James, like a lot of people, rode out the virus at home. He also missed 3 weeks of work. Now that he's back at work, James says behavior has changed. At the urging of public health officials, Texas put a statewide mask order in place early this month. James says that since that order, people around him are wearing masks more often, and they realize they're doing something wrong when they don't.
I had an apprentice show up at a job today, and I only have a mask from a couple days ago, so can you go inside the place and get me one? You know, it's like, you're supposed to have one. It's part of your PPE.
For people who can't work at home, the workplace has been the biggest issue when it comes to masks. Ashmeen Dean manages a dental office in the Austin area. She says her office was only closed for a few weeks during the shutdown, but when they opened back up, they created an office rule about masks. Everyone had to wear one, even the patients.
Most people were okay as long as I gave them one.
But Dean says there were patients ignoring the office's rules. And one time, it even got ugly between patients.
It was a really busy day, and I was by myself and dealing with, you know, multiple people at the same time. And a lady was sitting in my waiting room, and then another person walked in who didn't have a mask on.
Dean didn't notice this person immediately, but the woman in the waiting room did. And she says it started a fight.
And I was like, well, you know, I will provide her one. You don't have to worry about it. But that didn't stop them from, you know, arguing till I had to separate them.
Dean says before there was a statewide mask order, she was constantly put in a tough spot. She wanted to keep herself, the staff at the dental office, and all their patients safe. But at the same time, there were a lot of patients that just didn't want to comply with their rules.
Yeah. And, you know, then it becomes, I want to speak to your manager. And then, you know, you're like, well, I am the manager. The next step that happens is you read a bad review about yourself.
That's why Dean says she was desperately hoping state officials would issue a statewide order requiring masks. She says just having a company policy was just not enough.
Before it happened, at least 50% of people were walking in my office without a mask on. And eventually, I just got so fed up, I had to put a big old sign that mask is required. Even then, people just bypassed that sign and just walked in.
But right before the July 4th holiday, the state had an order in place requiring masks. Since then, Dean says she barely ever has to give someone a mask or even have to reason with a patient about it.
Right now, it's the law. They follow it. So there is a huge difference, and I'm really, really thankful for the mandate.
And this is a welcome relief for people who are just out in the world getting groceries and supplies. James McClure, who lives in North Austin, says he's been wearing a mask since March. And he's seen a lot more people doing the same ever since the order was in place.
I went to a Lowe's about a week ago. And when I was in line, there was not a single person in there that wasn't wearing a mask.
McClure says he wasn't the only person struck by that.
There was even one lady who walked in as I was waiting to check out, And she's walking up, and I could see she wasn't wearing a mask at all. And she looked around and got this funny look on her face, like she realized something wasn't right, and then sort of tucked her head down and pulled up her shirt. So even people who maybe aren't prepared or don't know, they're trying.
He says that's something he just would not have seen a month ago. McClure hopes this becomes a normal thing in people's lives. He says it's already become that way in his family.
If you had told me a year ago that I would have a box of masks in my kitchen and two or three of them in each of our family's cars, and we would never go in another building without wearing one, I would have thought you were absolutely out of your mind.
McClure says he hopes that this isn't lifted as quickly as the state's stay-at-home orders. In fact, McClure and others say they hope it sticks around until there's a vaccine, or at least until it's safe to be around other people again. I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Until last week, President Trump's 2020 campaign manager was a former San Antonio businessman named Brad Parscale. He's recently been demoted by the president to senior advisor for data and digital. Bill Stepien, a former White House political director, will take over. Parscale appears to have fallen in favor following a sparsely attended campaign rally in Tulsa in the middle of the pandemic, as well as plummeting poll numbers for the president. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flab takes a look at Parscale, a website maker turned politico, and how his rise in politics started in San Antonio.
Brad Parscale's only 44. He looks much older since he took on Trump 2020 campaign manager in February 2018. The campaign's been in free fall since the pandemic hit the U.S. in March. The toolbox and tradecraft in some ways pioneered by Parscale in 2016 have been unable to overcome the disastrous optics of a rising body count from COVID-19. Those tools, a menagerie of memes and ads micro-targeted on a variety of social media platforms, were all piloted in San Antonio.
I saw digital and data as the center of everything.
That's Parscale in March 2017 talking about his time running Trump's digital campaign the previous year.
And Mr. Trump's, you know, own personality and his use of social media allowed great opportunity for us to truly use the aspects of the internet to run a digital and data-driven campaign.
Parscale's familial relations, his loyalty to the boss, and his ability to hold on to a job while 2016 campaign managers were dropping all around him put him in a more powerful position than any previous presidential campaign digital director. But how does a San Antonio website maker get to the center of national politics? Parscale moved to San Antonio to play basketball at the University of Texas San Antonio. He injured his knee and so transferred to Trinity University. After a failed marriage and a failed business attempt with his father, Parscale started coding and selling websites.
All day, Monday through Friday, I would go on the road and just sell. And nights and weekends, I would just code. And I did that for 7 years without a day off.
He joined forces with successful physical branding guru Jill Giles in 2011 with Giles Parscale. About the same time, he landed his first Trump website. It was for their international realty company. In a C-SPAN interview, he says he bid low.
However, I knew it was probably a good step to get inside with the Trump organization, the Trump family. Being from San Antonio, Texas, we don't have a lot of Trumps in San Antonio.
Parscale was right. One website after another flowed to him. He often says his last website was the 2016 Trump for President site. Parscale was asked to be digital director of Trump's 2016 campaign. While he had helped create local advocacy organization TechBlock and was engaged on a couple of related city issues, other than a website for a candidate for county tax assessor, Parscale was thought to be fairly apolitical. In 2016, he said it was the chance of a lifetime.
I've been doing this for nearly 20 years. I never had the opportunity to have in this big of a game where I could show the different skill sets I have and bring teams together.
While Parscale remained a constant, campaign managers were rotated through on a semi-regular basis. First with Corey Lewandowski, then Paul Manafort, and finally Steve Bannon.
We spent 50% of our money on digital and 50% on TV. That's a groundbreaking thing for a presidential campaign.
For Republicans, this was an outsized role for the digital director to play. Parscale, a fiend for data, loved the large voter data sets from the RNC. He worked alongside Cambridge Analytica with its Facebook data set that would later sink the company in scandal, but it allowed Trump's campaign to spend less money more effectively. They would run hundreds of thousands of ads. some targeted ads got the campaign accused of voter suppression, which Parscale denied.
Did we do memes and we did things? Yeah, that's part of a political campaign. You show the contrast between your candidate and the other candidate. There was no voter suppression in the campaign.
However, Parscale acknowledged in an exchange with a Hillary Clinton campaign director that the Facebook ads, Parscale's dark art skills, were nearly impossible to track.
It was very powerful. The media had no idea unless I told them.
In addition to awakening Parscale's political beliefs, Parscale says the campaign taught him that the media is not his friend.
The media bias was horrible through that campaign. I think I was called a racist, misogynistic, anti-Semite. There was a few others mixed in there.
Ultimately, Parscale soured on San Antonio, and he said the feeling was mutual. He, like many, complained about the state of the city's airport. He built the website for and personally backed former Mayor Ivy Taylor, who lost that year. He moved to Fort Lauderdale and started Parscale Strategies, which began taking in millions from the Trump campaign. Since rising to campaign manager in 2018, Parscale's built a large network of digital collaborators and networks to speak directly to the president's base.
It's almost hard for me to think of the Trump presidency without Brad Parscale at this stage, because a huge amount of the marketing strategy has come from Parscale in some way, shape, or form.
Samuel Woolley is project director for the Center for Propaganda Research at the University of Texas. He says those networks would be difficult to navigate for a successor.
Were Parscale to be fired, I think the implications for the Trump team would be that the level of sophistication that they've been able to reach, albeit through third parties, would probably in some way go up in smoke.
This may explain why Parscale wasn't let go entirely. For now, Parscale remains a senior advisor to the Trump 2020 campaign. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. And Wells Dunbar joins us once again. He's monitoring social media across the Lone Star State. Hello again, Wells.
Hello, David. Well, as we heard a little earlier, Texas Republicans' virtual convention this weekend ended in disarray after a spate of technical snafus, this second convention being scheduled to tie up business, and divisive Tea Party Republican Alan West named new Texas party chair. Alan West, that name familiar to longtime politics watchers, primarily, as we heard, to his railing against the Obama administration in that era. Pat Bryan puts it less delicately via Twitter. He tweets us that West was a one-term congressman because he was so abysmally ignorant and offensive that Florida gerrymandered his district out from underneath him. Florida 22 there. So obviously a lot of interest there in the fact that, yes, a former Florida politician who has come to Texas, set up shop here in Texas, going to steer the state party through this very important 2020 election year. Lots more news sort of breaking as we go to air here, David. I don't know if you've had a chance to see this, but a letter in from 8 members of the Texas Capitol grounds crew. Actually, let me restate that. From 8 State House and Senate leaders calling for the removal of all Confederate statues and monuments on the Texas Capitol grounds. Really interesting letter here. It calls for, I think here, a total of 7 memorials from the Capitol grounds, including the Confederate Soldiers Monument. It's this big, huge statue on the Capitol grounds that has 5 statues of 5 Confederate soldiers standing atop them. Members of the House and Senate Administration Committees, all Democrats, signing this letter urging the removal of all Confederate memorials on the Texas Capitol grounds. And speaking of the Texas and lawmakers there, another interesting bit of news. This announcement from Comptroller Glenn Hager announcing quite a shortfall in the offing for Texas this next fiscal year. Trying to pull it up on my computer right now. Had it a minute ago, but it's not looking very good, quite honestly.
Yeah,
it is quite the turnaround from what we were expecting.
I'm looking at that. It's actually, he had originally said that there would be a $2.8 billion positive year-end balance. He's now saying that we'll have a shortfall of $4.5 billion. It's one of many stories we continue to track here at the Texas Standard. You can keep up with all the news 24/7 at texasstandard.org. And of course, we'll be back here tomorrow, and we hope you will join us.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.